This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to another exciting installment of 360 Biz. My name is Tebogo Mafodi, right here on Cliff Central. It is a beautiful Wednesday afternoon. Definitely, you know, this is a show that brings you all things business. I'm actually excited about today's show, that I've got gentlemen in studio that are good at their craft, that are good actually at what I do. Definitely, I'm not alone in studio. I'm with them. Unfortunately, my boy Bulelani Bala Bala couldn't be in studio with me today. You know, I always say business people don't become late. However, they become delayed. And it's definitely, this is a show that brings you all things business. If you want to join in on the discussion, you can always join in our social media. It's at cliffcentral.com. On Twitter, it's at cliffcentral.com. On Facebook, as well, we've got the Cliff Central page. If you want to follow me, it's at Tebogo Mafodi. On Twitter, it's Tebogo Mafodi as well. On Facebook, definitely. Today, we're talking artificial intelligence. As you'd know, that artificial intelligence, it's definitely an industry that is taking over many industries right now by storm. I mean, across different levels, across different platforms and world. Obviously, first world countries, they're one of the places that definitely has taken over artificial intelligence. I mean, it's something that is definitely growing on, and that is definitely taking up. I know that I've had an opportunity to actually as well attend an event where this discussion was actually discussed, but that is was around the legal services globally. And you know, in South Africa, there's a lot of evolving and the taking shape of the so-called fourth industrial revolution technology that is really disturbing and disrupting industries and businesses that need to be living up to that, businesses that definitely need to adapt and to change. You know that for Israel, that the 8 months of last year I've spent it, especially traveling, I mean, within the UK and the US space, I got exposed, I mean, to some of this revolution that is actually taking place. That's why today I've brought in a guest all the way from the UK, Mr. Daniel Suskin. I mean, who in him and his father, Richard, they've actually wrote a book called The Future of the Profession Predicted. I mean, they predicted the decline that is taking place today. I mean, within the traditional professional profession, I mean, including legal profession, including accountancy and very other professions that they've covered actually in the book. And they've taken place in the prediction, talking about, I mean, some of the systems that will be replacing their traditional way of definitely talking things. But obviously, I'm no expert in this book. Maybe let me take this opportunity to actually welcome Daniel to studio and let him be the one that tell us more about who he is and the book that he wrote. Daniel, do you want to say hi to our listeners? Tell us who you are.
Hello.
And what is it that you do?
Hello. Great pleasure to be with you today. As you said, I'm the co-author of a book called The Future of the Professions. And what we do in the book is look how technology is affecting the work of professionals, of doctors and teachers and lawyers and accountants and architects and journalists and consultants. And what we find very broadly, what the conclusion of our book is that we see two futures for the professions. The first one is what we say we feel is reassuringly familiar. You know, it's just a more efficient version of what we have today. And here, professionals of all different types use technology, but essentially just to make their lives a bit easier, to streamline and optimize the traditional ways in which they've worked. And as your listeners look around, there's lots of examples of this. It's doctors talking to patients via Skype. It's architects using computer-assisted design software to design bigger, more complicated buildings. It's perhaps a teacher who uses online material in the classrooms. So that's the first future. And as I said, I think it's a reassuringly familiar one. It's a comfortable one. But there's then a second future. And here, technology doesn't just streamline and optimize the traditional ways in which professionals have worked, but it actively displaces professionals from their work. What we call in the book increasingly capable systems and machines, either operating alone or just designed and operated by people that look quite unlike traditional professionals. They gradually take on more and more of the tasks that we associate with traditional professionals. And I think for now, we'll see these two futures developing in parallel. But in the long run, we'll see that second future dominating, that through technology, we're going to find new and better ways of solving the sorts of problems that traditionally only a very particular type of professional has solved, only a lawyer or a doctor or an accountant or a teacher. And we think, we argue that this will lead to the dismantling of those traditional professions. And that really is where the work that we did and our thinking led us.
But now, I mean, maybe you've touched on some very critical and I think interesting, you know, things that you've covered in the book. But maybe let's come to the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, Richard, Daniel, you hardly hear somebody write a book with their father.
Yes.
I mean, what were you guys sitting bored somewhere and you just decided, you know what, let's write a book.
Yeah. So my dad, his career, he spent the last few decades trying to understand how technology affects the legal profession, how it affects lawyers.
Okay.
And what happened was, I was working in the British government back in 2010. I was working in the Prime Minister's office on lots of different policy areas. But the point was, I had a good overview of lots of different professions. I was working with people in the tax world, in the education world, in the world of healthcare, and so on. And it was clear that significant change was in the air, and that these professions, although they were quite different, actually appeared to face a common set of challenges. And this is what my dad was finding as well, that people were approaching him who weren't lawyers and were saying, look, this is very interesting, but it applies to us as well. I'm an accountant, and what you're saying resonates. I'm a doctor, and it's true for me as well. So we had the idea of joining forces to look at the professions more generally. The great mistake, though, of course, is to think that having two people, particularly a father and son, writing a book means it takes half as long. It doesn't. It takes twice as long.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a better book for it. And it's in the book, we fought, we argued, we debated over every point. So in the end, we actually agree on everything. But it was a very, I think, productive partnership.
Oh, okay. So, and how is the market receiving the book, though?
Very well. It's interesting. In 2010, when we first began, there was kind of thinly veiled skepticism about the project. You know, people weren't as interested as they are in technology today.
Mm-hmm.
I think, particularly in the last year or two, we've seen changes in what, or kind of progress in what technology is capable of doing, that have made people sit up quite straight and take the ideas in our book very seriously.
Yeah. So now, I mean, with technology changing, it's actually worked to your advantage, because now, I mean, you kind of now be in a position to now put more emphasis on some of the things and the predictions that you've made.
Mm. I mean, the book, what we were arguing, what we were trying to set out, was a direction of travel. We were trying to describe how the worlds of doctors and nurses and teachers and accountants were changing, and in a sense, the last few years have been vindication for us, because they are, you know, one of the frustrations in writing a book is that very quickly the examples and the cases that you use become outdated. And you know, if we were to rewrite the book, we would have so much exciting material from the last few months, for the last few years, to add into it. So it's been vindication, I think, for the argument that we developed.
No, definitely. And we're not alone in studio. We've got Mr. Dean Shivers, who's the director for legal at Deloitte, who's also joining us. Mr. Shivers, do you want to say hi to our listeners? Tell us who you are and what is it that you do?
Morning. Pleasure to be with everybody. I'm a partner at Deloitte now. I look after the Deloitte legal business across Africa.
Oh, okay. So I didn't know Deloitte was a legal firm. We know it as a consulting firm.
So a common problem. So Deloitte is a professional services firm, focused on many areas. We started to build the legal business globally about 15 years ago, with the real impetus over the last 10 years. It's an interesting profession, a profession that hasn't been consolidated. There are no big players globally, and that's our goal to build. So we currently have presence in 78 countries, and that's our goal, to continue to build that.
Oh, so you guys have strategically positioned yourself.
We have strategically positioned ourselves. I mean, I think that I think we buy in very much to the theories that Daniel and his father have come up with, and we believe that is the future.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that, especially as it relates to data and technology, is going to be a challenge for traditional lawyers. And I think the benefit we have is that we have those skill sets within the firm, and for us, it's about how we leverage those globally to deliver better value.
Mm. So now, Dean, tell me, I mean, how did you become a lawyer? Did you start by becoming a traditional lawyer working at the courts, or from the onset you went on to corporate to actually practice law?
So I started as a traditional lawyer in a traditional law firm, joined Deloitte's 17, 18 years ago as they started up the legal practice. And I was drawn to the fact that they wanted to do something different.
Okay.
When we recruit people, our number one question is, do you buy into that different future?
Mm.
And if they don't, then we're not the place for them. So I've been intrigued by where the profession's going. I don't see that the future is something to be scared of. I think it's something to be leveraged.
Mm-hmm.
And so the excitement about where that's going as a profession is what keeps me there.
Mm. So now tell me, I mean, now obviously you've been with Devoland for all of these years, and obviously you've seen a lot of trends come in and out. So obviously, I mean, one of the things that we touched base on with Daniel is that obviously it's across different professionals that they've written and argued in their book. So what are some of the changes that you've seen take place in the legal fraternity?
So I think probably two of the main changes we've seen is, one, just the enormity and scale of the regulatory burden that's placed on companies these days, and it continues to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to solve for that challenge manually, as we've done historically, doesn't work.
Okay.
So we've seen how the use of technology and more recently the use of data analytics really helps deal with massive sets of challenges and massive sets of data.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's been the one change. And I think the other change has been around the fact that that traditionally a lawyer was a all-knowing, wise person,
mm-hmm.
and that these days, to give a genuinely all-encompassing legal service, you need various skill sets. You need technology people and analysts and org design people and a variety of other skill sets to really provide an all-encompassing solution.
Mm. So then now, I mean, is it something that now you felt, now I want to try to actually get to the point where you as a company decided to say you want to adapt and move with the trends? Because I understand, I mean, that's the direction that you guys are heading, right, at this point in time?
Correct. I mean, we're a professional services firm, best known for audit, I would guess, but we're a professional services firm.
Mm.
So the professional space is where we play, and the professional space is where we like to be dominant. The legal field presents an interesting question mark because, as I said earlier, it's not dominated by any big players.
Mm-hmm.
When last I looked at stats, no law firm had 1% of the market share.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a very diverse profession. It's a profession that more and more business demands be global. And so having that global footprint allows us to provide that from a global perspective and to start to make inroads into really taking hold of a fair percentage of that market share.
Mm. So now, I mean, Daniel, tell me, I mean, right now, obviously, since you've written the book, one of the things that I've realized by experience, I mean, I was a professional, I'm still, in fact, a professional and a businessman before in Anchor. So one of the things that I've realized, big companies and big corporates don't adapt easily to change. And it's some of the things that has been a challenge, I mean, over the years. Do you see more corporates now starting to adapt to change?
One of the things we say to professional firms is that the competition that kills you often doesn't look like you.
Okay, you got to repeat that again, eh?
Well, the competition that kills you doesn't look like you.
Okay.
And it's what we found in our work that often in any profession that you looked at, the most exciting change often happened outside the boundaries of traditional professional firms. And it's, you know, whether it's in education, for example, you have an organization like Khan Academy,
mm-hmm.
online collection of practice problems and instructional videos. It has 10 million unique users a month, so that's
sure.
More,
that's a big number.
More unique users than there are students in the entire primary and secondary school population of England. What's interesting about that is that it wasn't, I mean, although there are teachers involved, it wasn't designed by a traditional educational institution. It was designed by very different types of people. Or if you look in medicine, think about the most exciting work that's been done in diagnostics at the moment. It's being done often by large technology companies rather than traditional medical institutions, something like Google. Google have a artificial intelligence team called DeepMind, and some of your listeners might know it because it went on, it competed last March with Lee Sedol, who was at the time the world's greatest Go champion, and it beat him 4-1, something most people in artificial, but most people in artificial intelligence thought we were at least a decade away from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things that they did was team up with Moorfields Eye Hospital in in London to use the system to help diagnose and treat various types of eye problems. We've seen IBM with their system, Watson, using it to help diagnose and treat various types of cancer and post-traumatic stress disorder too. So again, this idea, and I think it's a challenge for the traditional professions, which is that, as I said, the competition that kills you doesn't look like you. And a lot of the exciting change is happening in quite unexpected places.
Yeah, no. And I mean, speaking the change of artificial intelligence in the medical field, last year I've had an opportunity of being in California.
Oh, yes.
And one of the friends that happened to one of the dignitaries that were hosting me works in a hospital. He's a doctor.
Yeah.
And it was shocking, some of the things that he was telling me is now the technology is doing in terms of diagnostic and, analytic of patients using technology. In that space, I'm sure it must be quite scary for some people, though.
Well, scary depending upon who you are. I mean, if you're a traditional doctor, then I agree that some of these technologies might be quite threatening.
Mm-hmm.
Many doctors keep it as a principle that the sort of diagnostic work that they do requires a sort of a special touch or a kind of je ne sais quoi. You have to feel, you have to look the patient in the eyes, you have to get a sense. A system could never do this. And yet we see systems increasingly doing that. So I think for traditional doctors, it is quite challenging. But from the point of view of a patient, I think it's a very exciting change. Most people don't have access to high-quality, affordable medical advice. And the promise of a lot of these systems is far, far better advice, far better medical insight. I often say that people ask me, how quickly will this happen? And in the medical setting, for instance, I think the sorts of changes that we write about on our book will really start to accelerate when a patient walks into a doctor's surgery and a doctor takes out their stethoscope and goes to put it on the patient's chest. And the patient says, whoa, 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 what are you doing?
Mm.
I don't want your intuition or your judgment. I want to use a system instead. They outperform you.
Sure.
I think that those are the sorts of moments when we'll see really significant change.
Yeah. I mean, Dean, you started off as a traditional lawyer. I mean, aren't you frightened by now technology coming to take over? That maybe, I mean, we'll end up having artificial intelligence in courts and, in commercial cases being involved, perhaps.
So it would be a terrible thing for me to sit here and say to your listeners that I am terrified. Like I just told you that I think that it's exciting, and I think it's exciting not just because we can find better ways to provide legal services. I think it's also exciting because it allows not only other skills into legal, but it allows legal into other places. So, to me, it's an exciting space to be in to say that, yes, we can provide legal advice and we can de-risk that space for clients, but at the same time, we can provide business value. When we're analyzing data in contracts under a contract management scenario, when you can actually advise business on things they could do better to become more profitable, things like that are exciting more than they are frightening.
Mm. So, I mean, I want to touch base on the survey that you guys have done, so that obviously we're able to let you go, and we have much more vibrant discussions. With Danielle. So now, I mean, tell me. The survey that you've done, I mean, it says you guys have studied over, 200 and something people, CEOs, general counsel, legal experts, and the likes across the globe, whether being CFOs, CEOs, and the likes in regards to where the trend is going. I mean, what has some of the findings from the survey that you've done?
Yeah, so I think we've always been interested in writings like those of Daniel and his father, and I think that they are certainly valid.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it was a question as to, is that now? Is it in the short term? Is it in the medium term? Mm-hmm. So the survey we conducted globally was across C-suite people and general counsels of large corporations across the globe to get their sense as to how are they feeling about these trends that are identified. Are they seeing it as real and immediate, or are they seeing it as something for further down the line?
Mm-hmm.
And the overwhelming response was certainly that they see it as an issue for now. Trends like wanting legal advisors who can give you seamless advice across the globe. The trend that purchasing patterns of general counsels are changing, that they're starting to acquire some of their legal advice from people who are not traditional lawyers or not traditional law firms.
Mm-hmm.
The ever-increasing role of technology and data. So these are the sorts of trends that we went to market to test whether they are valid and whether they are real right now.
Okay.
And they are. So for us, certainly vindication that we're on the right path and that we need to continue on it. And that defines to a large degree our go-to-market strategy.
So now, I mean, one of the things that, I mean, the survey makes mention of, I mean, it's the market is moving and growing. I mean, you've touched base as well. I mean, one of the things it touches base, the major purchases of legal services that are changing. The approach, are now people now buying more of legal services in the most innovative way or online?
So I think the legal challenges that companies are facing are also ever changing, and so it's inevitable that they will look at other things. That the developments that are in the legal space allow that. Certainly, the bigger law firms globally still maintain a very prominent role, and there's a huge amount of respect for what they do.
Okay,
but ultimately. These days, if you're a subject matter expert in something, regardless of whether you sit in a big firm or whether you sit at home, you're valuable. Some companies, and we're seeing a lot of it in the legal space at the moment, are providing outsourced legal service, outsourced legal services, regardless of whether they're lawyers. There's certain elements of legal work which are repetitive, and it can be dealt with from a machine perspective.
Yeah.
So there certainly are changing purchasing patterns. There are new entrants into the legal services space. And all of that, I think, is driven by the stuff that Daniel's spoken about, and also about the ever-increasing legal challenges that companies face as the economy becomes more global.
So now, I mean, one of the things that obviously in the trend, I was reading an article that was saying 40%, there's a 40% decline in terms of legal student intake within universities, I mean, since 2004. So now as a growing legal firm, I mean, are you not afraid that you're losing more of these young professionals to more emerging legal firms? Because, I mean, they seem or proving to be rather much more innovative or adapting in terms of digitalization of, I mean, the industry.
I don't think so. I'm not sure of the statistics, but I think that we have a good supply of legal graduates coming into the market. I think that if the challenge is there, it's probably more likely to be felt by the bigger, more traditional legal institutions.
Okay.
From our perspective, we believe we like to attract the legal graduate who is interested in stitching data and technology and org design and those sorts of adjacent skills into the legal advice that we provide. So for that group of people who that excites them about their career, that's who we're after, and it's probably not all legal graduates.
Yeah,
but for those who have that mindset, those are the people that we want in our firm.
So obviously, I'm sure obviously having the financial muscle, obviously, to upkeep them, it shouldn't be a problem for them to jump ship, obviously, and come work for a big company like yours.
So I like to think that that the attraction is the different way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think financial ability aside, I think the real advantage that professional services firms have going forward in many of the professional environments is the wide range of professional services that they have in-house.
Mm-hmm.
So it does become more of a question of how do you leverage the various professional skills across the globe rather than how do you go and acquire or to build it.
So now, I mean, in regards to, I mean, I've seen growing up that a lot of legal firms, legal firms, companies and the likes, they always love filing. You know, there's always, I don't know if you've seen Daniel, there's always big documentation, big files, and everything. I mean, so it's something that for me, I've seen like medically, in terms of adapting to, into the digital space. Now there's more electronic filing.
Yeah.
That is taking place. So,
yeah.
But I mean, obviously, other industries like legal are more adapting slowly.
Yeah.
As to more electronic filing. So, I mean, how do you think we could encourage other industries though in terms of adapting to that digitalization?
Yeah. Let me just make one observation about the point that you made before about how large professional firms recruit the right type of people. I think, again, just go back again to that point that I made before, that the competition that kills you doesn't look like you. The competition for talent isn't just between traditional professional firms. It's between professional firms and often large technology companies. Does somebody with computer science skills want to go and work in a large professional firm, or do they want to maybe go and work in Google? You know, do they want to work at Facebook? Or the sets of skills that are useful in increasingly important in the traditional professions are in demand, really across the economy. So the competition for talented people, I think, is more intense than it's ever been. I suppose the response to your other observation is really the advice would be, and it's advice that Jack Welch, one of the great business theorists, once said: change before you have to. If you don't keep up with the sorts of changes that you're describing, you will be forced to. This is the direction of travel. We're seeing technology in various ways become increasingly important in these different industries, and either you can make the changes on your own terms or you can be dragged into it. And I think that first strategy is the more compelling one.
And definitely, I mean, for you, Dean, you've been making the changes. So have you started electronically filing now and reducing the file stack?
So we certainly have. So, I mean, I think from a technology perspective, there are a number of tools that are in use, and I think we'll continue to grow that use. But I think it's more around having a different view on things than it is necessarily around just dropping a piece of technology down. I think if you take, for example, some of the challenges that are facing companies these days from a legal perspective, and we look at things like, as I said, regulatory compliance, we look at the challenges the financial services sector has with anti-money laundering regulation, you look at the new privacy regulation, you look at contract management and optimization, all of these things are things that would have typically generated mountains and mountains of paper. But if we look past the law for a second, look to the fact that these are all primarily related to data, understand the data. Use the data multiple times, get efficiencies within that. Sorting out the data question is sometimes more important than sorting out the legal question. Being unable to sort out the data problem will make it very, very difficult to sort out the legal problem. So I think it is about looking, past the very generic legal question and looking at what is the underlying things we need to get right to get ourselves to de-risk it from a legal perspective.
Okay. So now, it's something that obviously, challenges that are there in terms of implementation, obviously, of artificial intelligence. So, right now, let's get more to the global compliance. Doing more with less. You've made mention in terms of data. I think it goes back to data. And right now, obviously, we are on cyber risk as well. Right now, in terms of, the country, or should I say maybe the world. I'm sure obviously you're familiar with the cases where company data, has been manipulated by hackers. And it actually been, companies would get hacked and information would be stolen and would be released at a fee. It's something that obviously with now traditional companies, they're more like, okay, that's more traditional that we need to remain. Because you see now with this data thing, it can get hacked, it can get manipulated and whatsoever. What studies have you guys done in regards to now protecting yourselves, in regards to now adapting to the change and helping implement for some of your clients?
So I'm certainly not a cybersecurity specialist, and I won't pretend to be one. But I think that the challenge you raise is an interesting one, because it's a relatively new phenomenon that we're starting to see around the globe, which is that from both a risk as cyber is, and from a regulation perspective, as data privacy laws are, we're seeing more and more regulation that has global applicability. Mm-hmm. And looking at legal risk and compliance and managing that risk is not something one can do any longer from simply the perspective of the one geography you sit in.
Okay.
Being able to deal with these sort of risks is something that has to be dealt with from a global basis. Mm-hmm. These laws have multi-jurisdictional application. And that's a new perspective. The cybersecurity issues, the regulatory issues, the dealing with your suppliers from a contract management perspective basis, all of these are becoming more and more global all of the time. So we will continue to move away from having a national view on things and more to a continental and global view on them.
Oh, okay. No, definitely. No, I understand. So now for people that want to go through some of the survey that you've done for more in detail, where can they find it? Is it accessible? Is it open to the public? And
absolutely, it is. So if you were to jump onto Google and to go into the Deloitte Legal Global websites, you'll find all the survey detail there.
Definitely. For now, for some of the people that want to get hold of your company in terms of assisting, maybe let me ask this: what are some of the legal services that you guys are assisting companies with?
So I think a broad range of services all across corporate M&A, usual contracting services, through to tax controversy, labor, immigration. So the full tranche of legal spaces that companies are faced with. Mm. And there's all the detail around this is, as I say, on the Deloitte Legal website.
Oh, is it? What is the Deloitte Legal website?
Deloitte.com. So if you go in there and search on the legal page, you'll find all the detail.
Oh, okay, definitely. So then are you accommodative of small businesses or are you only looking for large corporates?
No, I think we at the end of the day, we speak very much about technology and data and the trends that are on the cutting edge of the profession. Doesn't by any stretch of the imagination mean that the things that we've done historically from a professional perspective are gone. We are still providing huge amounts of traditional legal work to traditional clients. Mm-hmm. Doesn't go away. It just means we have to do these things in parallel. So much of what we've done historically continues.
Oh, okay. No, definitely. So as I let you go, are you on any social media?
Via the website would be easiest.
Oh, okay, via the website. Oh, okay, no, definitely. No, thanks a lot, Dean, for your time and for that interesting conversation that we have. Looking forward to definitely bring you back in studio next time when we're tackling much more legal and specific matters. Hopefully you'll be able to assist us with that.
It will be a pleasure. Thank you.
No, definitely. Daniel, coming back to you, I mean, one of the things that having been in the States, I realized is that even in now your retail supermarket or stores, I found that by the tills as well, artificial intelligence is taking over. In South Africa, I know that it's a big industry that people are employed there to be packers, to be tellers, to be all of these things.
Yes.
But when you guys now come to the first world countries, you guys have fired everyone. There's computers and artificial intelligence technology there.
So let me say to your listeners that what we do in the book is it's not a story of mass unemployment. That's not the story. What we're trying to do is tell a story of redeployment, a story of how the sorts of tasks and activities that need to be done in the world of work are changing. So if you have a look, for example, at those systems and machines that are being used in supermarkets, you'll see those didn't appear overnight. Somebody had to design them. Somebody had to build them. People have to manage and operate them. There's new roles that have to be done. And I'd encourage people, in order to get a sense of this, to read our book, because it isn't popular commentary on the future of work tends to be that one day people will wake up and find a robot in their chair.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what's taking place. It's subtler than that. There's new roles that have to be done. There's new tasks and activities that have to be done as well.
Mm. Do you want to give us an example of some of these roles and these tasks that you make mention of?
Well, an interesting one that you talked about before was the security. Mm-hmm. The idea that as more and more of our lives become digitized, as more and more of our activity is done online or done in an electronic environment, what happens to that data, how we store it, how we manage it, how we make use of it, lots of sensitivities around that.
Sure.
And we think one of the roles that will become increasingly important, and we write about this in the preface to the new paperback version of our book, which has just come out, is the data security guard. It's going to be an increasingly important capacity for people to be able to make use of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one. And in the book, we identify 12 of these new roles that we think will become more important.
Is it? Do you know perhaps some of these roles by head?
So things like. Systems engineers, data scientists. We think there's a role for the empathizer, and we can talk a little about that. We think there are. We have a role for paraprofessionals, less expert people using these systems to do things that might have required more expert people in the past. So there's lots of different roles. The point I make in the professions is that many of these roles are unfamiliar to traditional professionals, and many of them require skills and capabilities that are quite unlike the sorts of things that many traditional professionals are trained to do. And so the challenge to all traditional professionals, whether lawyers or doctors or teachers or accountants, is to ask whether or not you're well prepared to be the person to solve these problems in the past, in the future, to do these new roles. And in many cases, it's not clear. Again, as I said, the competition that kills you doesn't look like you, and a lot of the most exciting change is often happening outside the boundaries of traditional professional organizations.
I actually love that statement that your competitor doesn't look like you.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I think the exciting thing about technology, though, is that obviously it's It's one, it's, it requires a new mindset thinking.
Yes.
And two, I think it gives an opportunity to people that normally wouldn't have an opportunity to compete.
Yes.
That's why right now you find people that are taking advantage of this. It's actually small businesses that are there, you know, trying to actually get you know what, get business out there and take on big businesses.
Yes.
Like some of these businesses that you see out there.
Yes.
I mean, I think very much it's very much exciting. I'll make an example.
Yeah.
Okay, you wanted to make
it? I also wanted to say it's exciting not only for the providers, but also for the recipients, for consumers. Remember,
you reckon?
Yeah, well, remember in the professions, right?
Yeah.
The traditional professions are creaking.
Mm-hmm.
There are not enough people. And South Africa, I'm sure, feels this just as much as Britain or the US feels it, that not enough people have access to affordable healthcare, good education.
That is
not
so
enough
true.
People know about their legal entitlements. Not enough people know how to manage their financial affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that these new technologies offer us new ways to solve these problems, then although they might be threatening for traditional providers,
mm-hmm.
traditional lawyers and doctors and teachers and accountants, from the point of view of recipients, I think they're very exciting. And it's often the case, and we slip into it all too regularly when we talk about technology, is that we ask, what does it mean for work? What does it mean for providers? When actually a lot of the optimism and a lot, I think, of the excitement comes from what it means for consumers.
Mm.
And when I talk to governments and policymakers about this, that's the point I really want to impress, which is that we have to not let anxieties about this, what this might mean for work, overwhelm the optimism and the excitement that we should have about what this means for the people who would traditionally be on the other end of that work.
I mean, you've made mention of consumers, but some of these consumers, I don't know whether it's from an Africa perspective, or whatever. But right now, in terms of the consumers as well, there's a big myth, around artificial intelligence, and especially when it comes to the workplace.
Yes.
So now, obviously, I know whether in Africa as a whole, I think worldwide, we don't adapt easily to change.
Yes.
It's even worse in Africa. I mean, that's why right now you find, I mean, South Africa, I think, they've slowly been adapting. I'll make an example. We know of old traditional radio.
Yes.
And right now, being Cliff Central, I mean, we're one of the first platforms to actually come and be a digital platform. And a lot of people, you know, there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear to say, no, you guys are making a big mistake. I mean, in terms of going digital, this and this and that. And guess what? Now, even old traditional radio are starting to join in.
Yes.
You know, and they're now starting to actually adapt. But now you find a way that when you go to the rural places, to the villages, to the township, with some of the people, the consumers on the ground, and these people, they all have cell phones.
Yes.
But now we're sitting with the price of data, you know, that is expensive for them to actually connect to the internet, for them to actually be exposed to some of these technologies. I mean, in the first world country, the UK or London, like where you come from, how long did it take for the change to actually take place?
Changes, I think the point you're making is absolutely right, which is that the pace of change differs across professions, it differs across countries, it differs across parts of countries, and it differs across different groups of people in different countries. The point I would want to emphasize is that what we're trying to do in our book is set out a direction of travel. We're trying to suggest the way, the direction in which we're heading. We deliberately avoid making the sorts of predictions that you want me to do, which is to say, you know, how long will this stuff take?
Okay.
Because the speed of change isn't in our hands. It depends upon so many different things. It depends upon the appetite for consumers, how angry are consumers that they don't have access to the data, that it's too expensive. It depends upon the government, you know, how receptive they are, the regulators, how supportive they are. It depends upon providers, how willing, in your case, radio stations are to change the way that they work. So there's a whole set of complicated factors that affect the pace of change. But the direction of travel is clear, which is that technology is becoming an increasingly important part of our lives. In some cases, in the professions, not just making the lives of doctors and teachers and nurses easier, but actively starting to take on some of the tasks and activities that we've traditionally associated with them.
Now, in terms of the myth and fear of jobs in the workplace,
yes,
I know a lot of people that are very fearing, I mean, technology taking over their jobs. They think they're going to be out of jobs. And I mean, as well, we've had testimonies of people that say, I was working here and they bought this machine and now I'm out of a job.
Yes. So the worry, I think, in the medium term isn't one of mass unemployment. It shouldn't be. The problem is one of redeployment, mass redeployment. It's how we give people – it's not that there's not enough work to be done in the economy, in most economies, although in some economies it might be different. But in general, it's not that there's not enough work to be done. It's that very often people don't have the skills and capabilities to take up that new work and to move across
– I like that, yeah.
Move through the economy. And that's – it's no less serious a challenge in the sense that if people don't have the skills and capabilities, then – they'll struggle to find work. So it's still in the end a problem of, you know, you might worry that it has consequences for work, but the nature of the challenge is very different. As I said, it's not that there's not enough work to be done, it's that there's work out there. It's just that people who are displaced or find parts of their work eroded by technology might struggle to learn the new skills and capabilities that are required. So it's, in a way, it's a training challenge, and some people might be comforted by that, given that people have had to adapt and retrain in the past. But I think some of the skills gaps are really quite large, larger than they have been before. And that's why I think the challenge isn't one to brush aside as an easily resolvable one. I think it's going to be a real challenge.
So coming to small business.
Yes.
Obviously, it's costly to implement artificial intelligence.
Yes.
Within the small business. And right now, do you think small businesses are taking advantage of?
You're right. It is difficult. On the one hand, small businesses can be more nimble-footed, more light of foot than larger companies. But on the other hand, they often lack the resources to be able to do the research and development that larger companies might be able to do. I suppose the strategy is to try, I imagine, to cooperate with other small businesses, to form networks and share resources and work together on this. Because, as I said, I think this is the direction of travel is clear, which is that these technologies are becoming increasingly important. And I think that is it does pose a threat to small businesses, to medium-sized businesses, and I think it's one they need to take seriously.
What do you think governments can do, though, in terms of assisting small business conquer this giant David and Goliath approach?
I mean, governments have. I think a lot of these changes challenge governments in a huge variety of areas. Partly there's the training conversation that we had before. Partly there's the regulatory story about how to create an environment that's supportive. Partly it's about one of the worries that I have is that the sorts of changes that we're describing often favor large companies. Lots of data.
That's
lots
true.
Of processing
that
power,
is so true.
Talented people. And you know, in our book, one way of thinking about what we're arguing in the future of the professions is it's a story of the decline of traditional professional firms, traditional accountants and teachers and lawyers and doctors and accountants, the decline of an old set of gatekeepers. But we might worry that there's a new set of gatekeepers, new organizations, not perhaps looking a lot like traditional professional firms, but certainly large and dominant in other ways. We might worry, as I said, about new gatekeepers. So I think there is a role for the government in trying to push back against that direction of travel towards larger companies.
Yeah, we're actually going towards the end.
Yes,
but now I want to touch. What are some of the benefits and risks of artificial intelligence, though?
Yeah. Well, again, just I want to come back to this point, at least in the professions, when we think about doctors and lawyers and teachers and accountants, is that most traditional professions are creaking. You know, not enough people have affordable access to expertise that's locked in the heads of doctors and lawyers and teachers.
That's so true.
And the promise of artificial intelligence and technologies associated with it is, in a sense, a liberation of that expertise, making it more affordable and more accessible to those who need it. That's the promise. But there are lots of challenges around how we retrain people to have the skills and capabilities they need, how we avoid, as you said, the shift towards large companies, how we really support that promise of as I said, a liberation of expertise. So I think the challenges are clear, and in a sense they're quite well rehearsed in popular commentary on these technologies. I suppose what I'd want to do is emphasize the reasons for optimism, which is that these technologies offer us the possibility of making lots of types of expertise more affordable and more accessible than they've been in the past.
So now, I mean, quickly, yes. The issue of cyber safety.
Yes.
Because I know that right now it's a world phenomenon.
Yes.
Where obviously the hackers are on the rise.
Yes.
You know, technology crimes are on the rise, and now, I mean, with this, I am adapting to artificial intelligence or technology.
Yeah.
Within the workplace or within the professional space, as per se. How do you think, it could actually be kept? I don't know whether you cover that in your book.
So we do, as I said, the paperback version of our book is now out.
Oh, okay.
So the future of the professions, I'd encourage people who are interested in this to take a look. In the preface of that paperback edition, we have a discussion on exactly this, which is that, I mean, in the hardback version, in the original version, we said we're not actually going to look at these issues.
Mm-hmm.
We recognize they're important, we recognize they're significant, but there's other things that we want to focus on. It's clear in the past 18 to 24 months that they've become more important. And so, as I said, in the paperback version, in the new preface, we look at them explicitly. And one of the conclusions that we draw is that one of the new roles that will be important is precisely this. It's the data security guard.
Mm.
It's the person who can... who's able to handle some of the challenges and problems that you've just identified.
No, definitely. You've made mention that people must read through and go through the book.
Yes.
So now where can people get the book?
They can get it in all good bookstores.
Okay.
But if they can't find it in the bookstore, they'll be able to find it online. And it should be available on most online bookstores.
Okay. What's the name of the book?
It's called The Future of the Professions.
The Future of the Professions.
Of the Professions, yes. How technology will transform the work of human experts.
Oh, okay. Great. No, definitely. No, I think it's exciting. I'm looking forward to actually going through the book myself to actually read some of the findings that you've actually found and made mention of. And I saw as well on YouTube, there's a video that you're actually discussing, that some of the the insight that you've shared within the book. I think it was at a university, if I'm not mistaken.
There's quite a few talks on there. So if people have their appetite whetted by the book and want to hear more, there's a variety of talks from both myself and my co-author, some which go into more detail on particular issues.
Is it? No, definitely.
Terrific.
Maybe obviously, I know people that are listening are dying for me to hear your opinion and how you're finding South Africa since you've been here for 24 hours.
Yeah, wonderful. I have only been here for 24 hours. I'm amazed at how what you call cold weather here is pretty temperate for us in the UK. So it suggests if I...
And you understand it is our winter, right?
No, I know, but calling this winter is... we would call this summer.
Oh, okay. No, definitely.
But it's lovely. It's a beautiful country. I wish I could stay for longer.
Yeah. Hopefully you'll come back and we take you to Soweto. We get him to eat God, all right?
Yes.
sounds wonderful.
Yeah, no, definitely. Are you on social media?
I am, yes. You can follow me on Twitter, which is just at Daniel Suskind. So, and that's Daniel spelled the traditional way. And then Suskind is Suskind. And if your listeners have thoughts, please do share them and I'd be happy to chat a little more.
Oh, okay, definitely. We usually wrap and close off the show in style.
Great.
30 seconds worth of inspiration to somebody that is listening.
From myself?
Yes.
Well, I think one of the consequences of the sorts of technological changes that are taking place is that people can feel quite pessimistic, can feel quite uncertain and quite anxious. And I suppose I'd encourage them not to feel that way. For those who worry about their work, I'd say again that there's going to be plenty of work to be done for some time, but the skills and capabilities required to do it will be quite different. So I think my advice would be agnostic and open-minded, and I think it's a time of tremendous excitement. I think there's lots of interesting work out there. And from the point of view of consumers, again, I think that's another reason for optimism. I think the traditional professions, traditional doctors and lawyers and teachers and accountants, their expertise isn't affordable or accessible to many people. So again, I think the promise of these technologies in making access to that expertise more affordable, more accessible is is another reason for excitement and optimism. So I saw I my advice would be to embrace the change rather than reject it.
Embrace the change rather than reject it. Thank you for Daniel for coming through to the
thank
show
you for having me.
And to South Africa. Looking forward to having further engagement with you, even when I come to London. You are brilliant. We
thank
really
you
appreciate
much.
It.
Pleasure to talk with you.
Definitely. If ever you've just joined, in, you can always go to www.cliffcentral.com to catch the podcast. And there's a lot of many exciting shows that we definitely have. Catch us again next time for another exciting installment of 360 Biz. My name is Debohoma Fodi. I'm out.
This is CliffCentral.com.